that's how broken so many of these systems are, and some of the consequences and some of the dialogue they have with law enforcement where they say, well, I caught this person with drugs. I want them to be charged with a drug crime. But the prosecutor has to evaluate and say, well, that's a small amount of drugs for personal use. Does that mean that that teenager shouldn't have access to educational loans? Those are some of the decisions we have to make. And I think the answer is no, absolutely not.
We're rolling. We are rolling.
Rolling out. This is a real thing. Real thing.
None of you have the balls to stop this.
Today.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now, 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 right now.
What's going on in Richfield right now?
With regards to what?
Anything. Your neighborhood, the city council, anything at all. What is happening in the city to our south in Richfield?
What's happening to the city to your south? Well, we continue, it was just a year or two ago that we were voted the best suburb. Which made all the surrounding suburbs sit up and take notice. Thank you, City Pages. In addition to that, we have gone through a lot of generational change. The median age of the city council dropped from about 65 plus to about 30. I became the old man on the city council in my 40s. And so
really?
we've been working through a lot of intergenerational change and casting new vision and building strong teams.
Well, I'm going to introduce the show. This is the Wedge Live Podcast. I'm your host, John Edwards, and my guest today is Simon Troutman. I want to say Troutman, but it occurs to
me.
I've never heard it said out loud. Is that right?
Perfect.
Simon Troutman is running for Hennepin County Attorney. He's a member of the Richfield City Council as well. Welcome to the show, Simon.
Thank you so much. Thanks for reaching out. It's great to connect with you.
What kind of events have there been recently for you to like connect with voters during the campaign? Is it entirely like virtual sessions, town hall type things? Have you had a lot of events to connect with people?
You know, it is virtual, but you know, if you're undertaking to begin connecting with people now, you know, it's late in the game. I'm not running because there aren't people to connect with, but running because of the deep connections that I have in a lot of communities. But of course, the county is a really big place. And so a lot of Zoom calls, some events, those are still complicated. It's a great privilege to have an occasion to meet with a lot of different kinds of people.
So when you talk to people and explain to them why the Hennepin County attorney's race, why that position is important and what it does, like what is your brief pitch to like connect with a voter who's not necessarily all that engaged with that, the idea of that being important? What do you tell them?
Oh, well, I think you take folks where they're at. And I think when we say that we're in the midst of a deep reckoning in our community, everybody kind of feels that in their gut. From the pandemic to the murder of George Floyd to the civil unrest and rising crime, everybody feels, I think, unease at some level. And we talk about what I think shared and common values are. And those common values are fairness, justice, accountability. But also safety. And so we start the conversation there. There are a lot of differences, but there's a lot of, I don't know anybody that wants accountability from the government, especially law enforcement, but doesn't expect to be safe in their own homes, whether that's Maple Grove or South or North Minneapolis. So that's usually where we start the conversation and why the county attorney's race is so important and why I think I'm uniquely equipped to stand in that space is that we have to not only reckon with what's wrong, but we have to do the deep work of repairing broken systems. And the county attorney is uniquely enabled to do that. in the criminal space, but also in virtually every meaningful form of government or government service that takes place through the county. And so unlike progressive prosecutors that like Larry Krasner, perhaps, or other folks that have purely prosecutorial tools, the county attorney actually has two divisions. And if you go to the county attorney's office, you turn to the left, there's a criminal division, and you turn to the right, there's a civil division with dozens of attorneys that are responsible for health and human services and child support services and transportation. And we have an opportunity both to describe, and I'm grateful for kind of a longer interview where we can talk about more granularly what is broken and how we can fix it and what we can build on. But we have an opportunity to not just reform policies. I think of policy reform as a memo saying, we did it wrong this time, I have a better way to do it. But my experience, both serving in local government with a budget roughly the size of the county attorney's office and a staff pretty similar, but also as an attorney that's built a law firm, has managed teams of lawyers, and as somebody that's been in not just one community, I'm a suburban council member that moved my office from Eden Prairie to Elliott Park here in Minneapolis, and am really pleased to do so and build power and wealth and serve the BIPOC communities primarily, not just on their worst days, but when we're on our best days.
You're coming to us from Elliott Park?
I am actually coming to you from Elliott Park. This is my office.
Cool.
in the Hinkle Murphy Mansion.
This is something that maybe I'm learning right now. You said you go into the Hennepin County Attorney's Office to your left, to your right. So you've got prosecutors on one side, and you've got like, what were the other kind of attorneys that the office has?
Well, so many kinds of attorneys. And so when you think of the prosecutor's role, like Larry, when you think of a district attorney, mm-hmm. a district attorney is the attorney that's the chief prosecutor in a judicial district. But Hennepin County is not just a judicial office. It's the county board that's responsible for a lot of state programs. And then a lot of city programs partner and flow through the county. And so health and human services are part, medical assistance is administered by the county, child support, child protective services, all those facets of government, the jails, or not the jail, there's one jail there, the county lockup, all that, the county sheriff has an attorney. That attorney is the county attorney's office. So some of the flexibility that the sheriff may or may not have to take certain action is guided by the county attorney's office. And so go ahead.
So in the way that like during a planning commission meeting or a city council zoning meeting, the city attorney will have a lawyer there to say, this is legal. This is not the county attorney's office has lawyers that support the work of the county. It's not just a prosecutor's office.
That's a perfect analogy. That's exactly right. Yeah.
That makes sense to me. I had never thought of that, but it makes sense. If anyone is familiar with like a city attorney's office, it's a similar thing. So coming out of 2021, I'm sure you're aware of the big public safety debate we had in Minneapolis about the charter amendment, and how that debate kind of turned into the mayor and the chief and the police against the city council. And it's like they want to defund us. We don't have resources to do our job. And now that ended in a way that that officer minimum was maintained and the mayor and the chief kind of won that debate. And so now as we move into 22, talking about Hennepin County's top prosecutor.
Yes.
And so the tone of that debate has kind of shifted in a way that the police and police chiefs in Hennepin County are saying, well, hey, we need to look at the prosecutors. The prosecutors aren't doing their job. Crime is out of control, and it's the prosecutors aren't holding people accountable. I'm sure you have seen that dynamic play out. And police chiefs have had criticism for the current Hennepin County attorney Mike Freeman. So I'm wondering, like, to what degree do you buy into the criticism that the police chiefs are making against Mike Freeman, or do you think it's simply deflection?
That's a good question. I think both are probably true. I think one thing that's really useful is to take a step back and locate what's happening in Hennepin County and in Minneapolis, also in greater Minnesota and in the country and even globally. And we see crime rising globally, and we see crime rising across the country, and crime is rising in rural Minnesota as well. And so part of the conversation we need to have is not, I mean, it's helpful to say, is this policy working or is that policy working? But there are also, we also have to recognize we're in the midst of a community reckoning where there are a lot of people who are choosing to commit crimes at a higher rate. Specifically, carjackings come up a lot. Rise in violent crime comes up a lot because that breaks the fabric of trust. People feel unsafe. And if you don't feel safe, it's hard to talk about anything else, frankly. And whether that's based in reality or perception, it doesn't matter. You live your life, either feeling safe or feeling worried and not at ease. So I think the fact that crime is rising, obviously true. There's a catch and release policy from Hennepin County. That's tough because we don't have perfect bail data and we don't have release data, so we can't actually say granularly this is what's happening or what's not happening. Two of the differences: there's a difference between car theft and a carjacking, where you use violence to steal somebody's car, because that's one is a crime of violence, one's a property crime. And one of the things we need to continue to increase are risk-based assessments, and potentially elevating those risk-based assessments to say, if somebody has been charged with one crime and then while that crime is pending, there's another crime, particularly a crime of violence, that makes a much stronger case that liberty should potentially be withheld. One of the problems that we have with the bail system is that liberty is withheld because of statute, because of state law, not because of the county decision, because people have a right to bail in Minnesota in our constitution. And so that right to bail means if you have money and you can trade money for liberty, people with more money will have more liberty. And so that's wealthy people, and that's people that are potentially more engaged in organized crime. So really, it's not that's not a great system to say you're at risk. We need to remove you from community. There's an example. There's a client that I have who's been the victim of serial identity theft, not just the online, but they forged false documents for my client. And every time they get out of jail, they've stolen allegedly tens of thousands of dollars, and they've been charged multiple times. And this person's been released, and then less than 48 hours later, they're in my client's bank using false documents, pulling more money out. And when you're stealing tens of thousands of dollars and then the bond is $15,000, and then you can say, well, that's a property crime, so it's not, you're not actually, we're not as worried about you. But I think a better risk assessment tool is how likely is it that you're going to continue in a pattern of criminal behavior? And that's really what needs, that should be the deciding factor, not whether you're wealthy, not whether you have access to capital, and not whether not simply whether the crime is violent, although certainly once violence involved, that creates more risk to the community.
Right. So I think I would describe Mike Freeman as kind of old school DFL traditional prosecutor. He's not one of these progressive prosecutors.
Yes. So not until the last 6 weeks, right?
Right. What's happened in the last 6 weeks?
Well, I'm just saying the conversation with around the carjackings. I think if anybody were to come in the last 6 weeks and they didn't know there's no 30-year track record, I don't think everybody would be forgiven for thinking Mike Freeman was the most progressive prosecutor.
He's Chesa Boudin out of San Francisco. That's Mike Freeman has become Chesa Boudin and Larry Krasner.
It's interesting how quickly that narrative changes in the media.
So you would think there'd be a contrast with John Choi, but both Freeman and John Choi are the target of police officials in their respective yep. counties for, you know, it's their fault. They're not prosecuting. They're not charging people at the right level, or people are getting out. And it's hard to suss out what is actually true.
Mm.
But I guess my question is, do you like what John Choi is doing in Ramsey County? Because I think there is a difference between Choi and Freeman. Choi, for example, has said he's going to stop prosecuting most felonies resulting from pretextual traffic stops. So, for example, so one question, do you see John Choi as a model you'd like to emulate? And on the pretextual traffic stops issue, like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I do like John Choi's leadership. I'm a fan of John Choi in his leadership and a lot of the things that he's doing. And one of the benefits of running and watching John Choi's leadership is we can see how it works out in real time. And I think by and large, he's making great decisions. When it comes to pretextual stops, I think he's modified it a little bit because, you know, if you find a stop and it's legal and there are multiple handguns in that car, it's a legal stop and there are illegal guns in that car. That's a really tough call. And I'm glad that John Choi is using the discretion to say there are times where we need to keep people safe, but we also, and I know we've had this issue in Richfield too. What's the limit of a constitutional stop? And that you, in addition to creating policies like that, there is training that can be done. And there are, and I know that there are a lot of local law enforcement that didn't appreciate this, but I believe Mike Freeman also said, we're not getting all the evidence that we need to make the charges that we need to make, which is understandable, especially when carjackings have multiple crime scenes and they go from car to car to car, and it can be complicated. And so training is really important. There was a neighbor of mine that got a ticket for parking while black in Richfield. and what happened is, I think it's a great illustration of how we can reflect on different perspectives in law enforcement, because my neighbor is an African-American man, East African man, sitting in his car on a cell phone a couple of blocks away from our house, or his house, my house. We live in close proximity. And he's much more polite than I am. I sit in the phone in my driveway for 20 minutes talking on the phone with my wife saying, you know, why aren't you coming in? He went a couple blocks away. And that was a scary moment for a neighbor who said, there's a black man on my block. Maybe did not use his race, but that was an occasion for the police. The police come and they stop him. And they say, well, someone said you're suspicious. He said, well, that's okay. I'm not operating a motor vehicle. You can run my plates. I own a house here in Richfield. And I said, well, we can't let you go until we ID you. He said, well, no, I don't need to give you my ID because I'm not operating a motor vehicle. I haven't been suspected of a crime. And this was not somebody with that, am I being detained kind of energy. Very respectful. And what the officer said to dispatch, officer was also very respectful, but he said, this guy's being so dumb. He's so dumb. Why doesn't he do this? And what he didn't know is this gentleman was a federal investigator, former peace officer, not an axe to grind, just wanted to exist in his city without having to present his papers. And a lot of times when we have these conversations about pretextual stops and about police community relations, it's oftentimes over great violence, over profound damage and rendering of the community that's already been done. I think a lot of the incredible work that we can do is to build bridges and do training right in these smaller interactions. Not that we don't need to ignore instances of police misconduct, but a lot of trust is eroded on a daily basis. That's not the first time that man's been stopped. For most folks, I'm Puerto Rican, I'm very light-skinned, but my family, my friends, people in my social circle, I have a different experience with law enforcement. And getting at those fundamental interactions is actually a very fruitful way to build trust. And when it comes to pretextual stops, in addition to policy changes, there is robust training in policy parameter changes that we can engage in.
So what do you do when an officer, a particular officer, you notice in cases that you're prosecuting, thinking about yourself as the next Hennepin yeah. County attorney, potentially, just they lie under oath. They're just a problematic witness. They're not doing their job very well. These things are coming to light and you notice the pattern. What is it that the Hennepin County attorney can do about problem officers?
Well, that's a little bit of a broad category. So I want to be a little more granular, but when an officer has a pattern of lying, they're a bad witness. As a prosecutor, you don't put bad witnesses on the stand. And so that will involve some judgment, because a mistake is not the same as a lie. If you get something wrong on a report, that's not necessarily a lie. But if we have a record of falsehoods, in Richfield, we had a case of a repeated failing to document uses of force, abuse of force. We had a situation where the officer was documented striking and then shoving a young man in our community, failed to report it. This was, I'm going to get the number wrong, maybe a dozen. We've had a dozen such incidents in like a 6-year period. It's been a couple years, so forgive me if I'm fudging the facts. But there's a clear pattern of misconduct, not getting it right, retraining. We moved to fire that officer, and there's actually a Supreme Court case in our city that said we had to take that officer back. As a prosecutor, we need to know that when we put that witness on the stand, they'll be credible. And something else that has come to light in this past year is that, particularly in the Minneapolis Police Department, there's been coaching. I'm not sure if you followed that story where there's instead of documenting a discipline, there's coaching even for sexual misconduct. You'll coach, and then that information was not disclosed to defense attorneys. And systematic disclosures like that help to bring clarity of who is a good witness and who is not a good witness, and that hopefully strengthens the hand of chiefs of police and officers. A lot of good officers who don't want that kind of disintegrity, lack of integrity within their core. Right now, it's really tough to remove those officers, and so the county attorney has a really vital role in strengthening other law enforcement agencies and not inviting officers like that to testify is one of the ways.
So here's a fun question from your website. You say you worked at Yellowstone National Park, and that's where you met your wife. How did that come about?
You know, we both worked out in Yellowstone National Park our freshman year of college. And so we worked in the park. I met her there. There were not a lot of Puerto Ricans hanging out at 12,000 feet, and we fell in love, and now this June it'll be 20 years.
What were you doing there? What was your job?
My job, I did two things. It's some of the best jobs I've ever had. I was a gas attendant, and okay. for the Yellowstone Park Service Center, and I was a server in the local concession stand. And
The same time or like,
no, I actually worked out there two summers, but, to sit outside and, only New Jersey and Oregon allow you to pump gas, or forbid you from pumping your own gas. So when you go out there and pump people's gas, I've never met friendlier people when they were just pleasantly surprised. Everybody was nice to me. And when there was nobody there, I just got to watch the bison and the elk in the mountains and read a book. So that was two summers. It's a great time. I've not thought about that. I mean, I think about that, but no one's ever asked me about that.
You put it on your website. Wedge Live is going to catch it.
There you go. So that's how I met my wife, though. We were working out there.
So we've talked about the increase in violence, both in Minneapolis and Hennepin County and across the country, across the world, as you say. What is your public safety function? What can a prosecutor do? And let's talk about what you can do differently to keep people in Hennepin County safer. Like, what do you do differently to keep us safe? That's not happening now.
That's a really great question. And prosecution is different than public safety. It's a function of public safety. And part of what we can do is start by just identifying what leads to more crime. And, you know, particularly, you know, we call folks frequent flyers, or people who continue to come back a lot of times with escalating crimes. What can be disruptive to that? What can keep people from spiraling down that path? Number one, first and foremost of the three things, you have healthcare, mental health care, particularly substance abuse is huge. That you can't really talk about public safety and not talk about substance abuse. But I put all that in one category: housing, access to housing. People have housing, they're much less likely to recommit crimes. And then the last piece is employment, meaningful, gainful employment. And so part of what you can do as a prosecutor is help pair. And this is also when you're looking at the function of the prosecutor, also the attorney for all the other systems in the county, are to intervene. We have drug courts. We could potentially expand those drug courts. They're not the right solution for everybody. They tend to be very invasive. But a lot of times can be really effective. And both the drug courts, the veterans courts, the specialty courts really sometimes do a better job of looking at the whole community to seek and pulling more resources together to disrupt those patterns of behavior, scaling that. Restorative justice is also a really powerful tool. I want to circle back to that, but I want to talk for a moment about jobs and meaningful employment. And one thing you said, you know, who do I have an opportunity to talk to? Every time I have an opportunity to talk with large institutional employers, and that includes at the corporate level and in local government and at state government, I'm asking folks to help me build a pipeline, and we're calling it prison to labor pipeline. But it's not really prison, because 70% of people that commit felonies and are convicted of felonies don't actually go to prison, but still have all the collateral consequences that keep them from getting employment, keep them from getting housing. And so part of what we can use the bully pulpit of the county attorney to do is to really call. And I know that Mike Freeman is doing this even now, talking about HEAL 2.0 and inviting other community organizations to participate. But really, it's not. It's great if General Mills will make a contribution to, you know, a nonprofit. But really, what's important, we led the country in some ways. We weren't the first, but we were one of the first states to ban the box to allow people with criminal records to at least get a job interview before a criminal background check. But we really need to take the next step. And the next step is really launching people from the carceral system into full employment, because it's not enough to just say, we're going to take away most of your avenues for getting meaningful housing, most of your avenues for getting employment. The consequences for substance abuse have now gone really high. Go make your way in the world. And that's currently a recipe for less public safety. And so that's something else that we can do.
On your website, you have actually got into some specifics, which I don't want to like besmirch some other candidates, but I think it's one of the first websites I've looked at. And I know it's early in the campaign, and I know it's difficult to like get a whole detailed platform up there, but I'm trying to say something nice about you, which is you've got some specific ideas there on your website. And one of them is moving resources to prosecuting wage theft. So where would we take those resources from? And talk a little about why you want to do that.
No, well, thanks for that question. And so there are different resources within the county, and then resources outside the county. And part of part of the privilege and challenge of being in municipal leadership is you see the difference between policy reform, which is we need to do something differently, and actually identifying how the systems are broken. And the systems are usually broken, like you said, is it the police officers that are getting it wrong, or is it the prosecutor's office that's getting it wrong, and who's really to blame, and as a student and as a close observer of politicians, you see us doing that every single day, right? The problem's really at the legislature. This is never more the case than with wage theft. And for folks that don't know what wage theft is when an employer refuses to, and it's not when you have a mistake and you forget or you underpay somebody. It's not if you fail in business, it's not a crime to fail in business. But when you intentionally do not give workers the wages that they've earned, it's a crime. And a lot of people don't know that. And so part of what we can do and part of what I've been doing, I started to found a group and chair a group called City Leaders Against Tax Fraud and Wage Theft. And that's city leaders from not just around Hennepin County, but also Ramsey and Dakota, all the way down to Rochester, that are getting together to build power and pull resources together and pull attention together. And I'm so grateful you asked about this, because this is part of how we change this conversation, to say this is also a crime. And right now, I used to say there's been one wage theft prosecution in Hennepin County. One. And then when I talked to the prosecutor that brought that case, it was the Batras case. I said, well, basically that was a human trafficker. And yeah, the guy that trafficked humans also didn't pay them, but I don't count that as a wage theft case. And so what we have the opportunity to do is first change the imagination in law enforcement. I've talked to police and chiefs of police and detectives all across Hennepin County. Not one single law enforcement officer immediately recognized that this was a crime. So there is a lack of imagination. It's kind of like how we used to think about domestic violence. Like, oh, that's terrible, but that's a family matter. That's not something that law enforcement can't do that. It's complicated. Witnesses change their mind. We'd like to do something, but we can't. I'd like to just share two quick stories about this. I had a client that was accused of stealing a cell phone, he's a African American man, good personal friend of mine, homeowner, father of four, in his maybe late 40s to early 50s. He was accused by his employer of stealing a cell phone that was recovered, and not only was he arrested, but he was arrested at his second job, and they made sure that they let his second employer know, we are arresting him because we think he's a thief. And that was over a cell phone that was recovered. And it took a year to get that case dismissed. I have another client right now that is a tech salesperson, works with large commissions, had a $7,000 commission withheld because his employer was angry that he took a better job. And he just said, how dare you do that to us? We're not going to pay you. And right now, the imagination is that $7,000 theft is something you have to hire a lawyer for. But if an employer, if a corporation says, oh, you know, we think somebody took something from us, you have 100% subsidized investigations through law enforcement that have warrant powers. And then you have 100% subsidized detention capacities. And then you have subsidized attorneys that bring those cases, and they do that routinely. We've built systems. So it starts with having those conversations. It starts with reprioritizing. Obviously, violent crime continues to be an issue. Drug, minor possession, drug crimes, I think are over-criminalized and over-prosecuted. That's one resource. But also, as we have a conversation with the legislature about where we're going to invest budget dollars for our surplus, these are areas not to destroy corporations. As a business owner, I really appreciate when my competitors don't steal from me or don't steal to get a competitive advantage. You know, this is an opportunity for profound growth in our thinking and in our practice in law enforcement.
So Hennepin County is a big place. It's like 1.25 million people. And in Minneapolis, the concerns are violent crime, shootings, murders, carjackings. Those are the kind of things that people would be concerned enough to like call the Hennepin County attorney and say, hey, do something about this. Prosecute these crimes. If you move out to like Minnetonka, people are concerned about their unlocked cars being rifled through, things like that. So it's, there's a wide array of concerns in the county. And how do you navigate that?
There are a number of ways, but I just want to make sure I understand your question.
It's a bad question. I'm sorry. I don't blame you for that. I just mean, there's a lot of people in Hennepin County and there's a lot of different perspectives on the criminal justice system. Some more conservative, some more like, nobody in Minnetonka has a reason to be afraid of the person rifling through their car to steal a change. But, you know, if that's your circumstance, that feels like a big deal to you. You feel violated in that moment. And
you are violated.
I don't know. There are different perspectives and you've got to represent all of them. It's a very broad question. You can answer it however you want.
No,
because well, I know no, it's thanks. A bad question.
I think it gets at something really elemental, which is when people have different experiences, we not only do we live together metaphorically, we share the same county and we share the same resources and we share the same structures. Even if we don't, we have very different law enforcement agencies. We have the same system that has to collaborate and partner together. And one of the things that it's an incredible privilege for me to do as a council member, as a lawyer that chooses to be in community, as someone that runs for county attorney, you know, the conversations that you say, am I getting to have? There was a really powerful conversation we had about 2 weeks ago with a retired police officer in South, his beat was South Minneapolis. And who's now a lay minister at a local church. And so we talked and I said, well, what time about when were you a police officer? And he said, you know, it's this time, you know, early 2000s, late 90s. I said, well, that's when I was an undergrad in South Minneapolis and I gave a police brutality and police abuse of power survey. And I said, would you like to know what, you know, a customer service experience survey from 20 years ago. And he said, well, sure. We gave that survey, on Lake Street, on Park and Lake Street and in Uptown, just asked people if they ever had personal experience with police abuse of power, or if they knew anybody that had ever had experience with police abuse of power. And in Uptown, in Lake Street, or in Lunds Byerly's on Lake Street, it was just Lunds back then. Almost all Caucasian, I think, as my memory serves, now it's been some time, zero personal experiences, but also zero third person. I don't know anybody who's ever experienced police abuse of power. On Park and Lake, closer to where I live, that was all African-American and Somali participants, 100% personal experiences with abuse of power. And that's how big the gap was in the 90s. I'm kind of curious to give that survey again today to see what that, but that gap is still profound. It still exists. And so how do we have that conversation? I feel compelled to center my leadership in those experiences, in those stories, and to pretend like that's not the reality is not helpful for bringing us all to a place that I think is held in common, which is everybody wants to be treated fairly. Everybody wants to be safe.
So I've spoken to two other candidates before you, and you're the first one to call me on that question, how bad it is. So
well,
congratulations to you.
They intuited it much, much more clearly.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe you're just, you have more courage than they did.
I'll take it.
So you're running for a job that is pretty far downstream in the criminal justice process. Like society has, by the time things get to you, society has failed, right? In a lot of ways.
I like where you're going. I'm just going to step in and remind you that the county attorney also has responsibilities upstream, but I see where you're going. And so I want to continue.
All right. Well, you're getting a little too courageous interrupting my question. Oh, sorry. but what do you do
this when again, we'll get it right.
Yeah. What do you do when the system fails? Like there is a limit to how far upstream you can get. You're not running for state legislature or governor or president. Like there's a lot of other levels of government that can fail really hard. And then you're left with some of the responsibility to handle it in the courts. What do you do when the system fails? Are you kind of, how out of luck are you? How many options do you have?
Well, so that's one, it's a good question. And two, we have the options we have now, and we have the options that we can build. And one of the realities that we have is that currently 70% of the people that commit felonies are not going to go to prison. And so that's, I think sometimes we have this idea that when people commit a crime, we lock the key, we throw them away, and those are the people that did that thing. Now somebody finally had the courage to convict them. Now we move on. And so you're absolutely right. I think you frame the issue precisely right, that we're sort of the system of last resort, right? You have your family system, and then you have the school system, and then you have your different employers, and you have government supports, and you have health and human services, and you have all those systems. And you hope that at some point, one of those systems keeps people at least moving forward enough that they're not breaking what we call breaking the law, which is things that we put categories around that say this is so disruptive, this breaks so much trust, that there are going to be permanent, oftentimes permanent consequences. So what can we do? One, when people do break trust and are unsafe, there are many, many times when we need to remove them from community. And that's not just for the survivor's sake, but that's for the greater community's sake. And there is real value in that. And when people see that happens, it helps put some confidence back in the community that this is a safe place, that this is a place where I can walk outside outside my home at night and walk my dog and not feel unsafe. So there is value in that for community. But to recognize that almost all those people, high 90%, in the high 90s of those people that go in are going to come out. So are they going to come out to gainful employment? Are they going to come out and are they going to be able to find housing? Are they going to come out or are they going to meet what we call collateral consequences? And so for people that aren't familiar with that term, those are all the things after you've paid your debt to society that prevent you from renting a home, that prevent you for drug crimes still, that prevents you from accessing a lot of federal loans for education. So that's how broken so many of these systems are, and some of the consequences and some of the dialogue to have with law enforcement where they say, well, I caught this person with drugs, I want them to be charged with a drug crime. But the prosecutor has to evaluate and say, well, that's a small amount of drugs for personal use. Does that mean that teenager shouldn't have access to educational loans? Those are some of the decisions we have to make. And I think the answer is no, absolutely not. Cutting people off from education is not a good pathway to keep people safe. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Do we stop prosecuting people for drug use, those small amounts?
I think that is a very good direction to go. I think it's not a universal policy. That's something that the legislature will ultimately have to reckon with. But absolutely, absolutely increasing our capacity for diversion when it comes to crimes like that. And when it comes to property crimes and even violent crimes, looking at tools like restorative justice that statistically are incredibly disruptive to future crime. And so we have to balance the the notion of fairness, that somebody did something, you know, physical to my body, and I want something to happen to theirs. And that's why practices like restorative justice really need to be rooted in the voice, and are rooted in the voices of survivors of crime. Because the first person, and one of the privileges I have as a lawyer, is to fight for people at the margins. The folks that are first at the margins, that have first been marginalized in the criminal justice system, are the victims of the crime. And then we have the community. But then if we're not careful, we also have the people that have perpetrated the crime that we can not just over-prosecute, but prosecute and then leave to a system in our greater community that does not create a path that makes public safety likely.
Let's talk about police accountability.
Sure.
So when it comes to the George Floyd murder, Derek Chauvin was prosecuted by the Attorney General.
Yeah.
Kim Potter was prosecuted by the Attorney General. That's not really a formalized process. Those are just things that we kind of did in the moment. Should it be formalized? Because it seems to me, if we had a Republican Attorney General, that maybe wouldn't be a good thing. Mm-hmm. So what should be the practice in those cases where you're prosecuting a police officer? Should it be the Hennepin County attorney who does it? Should we just elect someone we trust and have that person do it? Because it worked out well having Keith Ellison do it. It might not work out well in the future.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really, that's a good question. And I think that's potentially a very good path. In the absence of any other path, that's how our system is set up to work. That the county attorney is elected by the people, we're accountable to the people, and we either have a mandate and trust to make those tough decisions or we don't. However, functionally, there may be better systems. I think looking at the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office, potentially working with them, creating a system that evaluates police misconduct, that sits in some ways outside, even in an advisory role outside of the county attorney's office, could be useful. And one of the challenges of those decisions is that there are always tough decisions, and this job has more tough decisions than most. But creating a sense of fairness for the officers, I think there's a sense in groups of people that feel like they're not being treated fairly. And lots of people have lots of different feelings or thoughts about this, but officers don't feel like they're being treated fairly. And particularly, they don't feel like they're being treated fairly by the county attorney. And so whether that's right or wrong, that's a perception problem, and that's a relational problem that the county attorney has to deal with. So absolutely, county attorney is responsible to make those tough decisions, but there is a conflict of interest that's inherent in that decision being solely between colleagues. And really, chief law enforcement officers, county attorneys, law enforcement officers, and assistant U.S. attorneys, they're colleagues. And so that creates problems, not just for your leadership, but for community trust, both within law enforcement and within the community. So I think there are different systems worth exploring, but ultimately it's the county attorney that has to decide.
Okay. I think this is the toughest question I might ask you in this whole episode. Richfield City Council Pledge of Allegiance. You're still doing it over Zoom. It's very out of sync.
If everybody is able to unmute yourself and put your camera on, if you can, and join us in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, everyone.
I don't know why they don't do it in Minneapolis, and it's not that I'm not a patriotic American.
That's what I heard.
But why do we make adults recite the Pledge of Allegiance over Zoom in 2022? Maybe at the next meeting you could make a motion to end the Pledge of Allegiance at Richfield City Council meetings.
I'll submit it as a note from a concerned non-constituent and see how the community feels about that. No, I think the simple answer there is so much has changed in this pandemic. Even if it's awkward, it's a privilege to maintain that tradition of saying the Pledge of Allegiance. I don't think we have any plans of changing that.
They could at least let you turn your camera off. It's very embarrassing. I wouldn't want to do that.
I feel not embarrassed by it.
Oh, you're not embarrassed by it.
I say that with trepidation, knowing your excellent media skills and city council members.
I'm curious how many city councils do that, because I'm constantly focused on Minneapolis, and when I watch a YouTube channel from some city, it feels like maybe that's the standard practice to always do the pledge. Is Minneapolis just weird and communistical?
I think it's an outlier, probably.
Okay. Well, it feels normal to me. Let's just get on with today's business and not do an out of sync Pledge of Allegiance into our webcams.
Fair enough.
Is there anything else that we need to cover that we haven't covered?
You know, one thing I want to mention, just because I'm really excited about it, we had a great civil rights and voting rights victory this last week with my office and with a great organizer and activist, Noah McCourt, and the DFL party. And by victory, it's a legal victory, so it's complicated. But Mr. McCourt is a returning citizen on probation. And also on the DFL Disability Caucus, exceedingly involved, actually one of the most effective disability lobbyists in the state, I would say, and a very young man, very bright, but not allowed to be a delegate. And so he approached me saying that this seemed not right, that he wouldn't have the freedom to not only to not vote, but to join a private organization and advocate not just for who the candidates should be, but what the party platform should be. That seemed to violate his speech rights. And he asked me, he said, could I violate my probation if I broke this law? And the question was, yeah, maybe. It's not clear. It's not clear how it's going to be enforced, but absolutely. And so the DFL had been interested in changing that rule, but they also did not want to break the law. So we won. We didn't win the appeal. The appeal said we're still dismissing this case, but they found three really important things. They found that Mr. McCourt and also non-citizens could not be found criminally liable. There's no penalty that they could suffer, and that the threat of government action is enough to destroy speech. They don't actually have to lock Noah up to give him to take his speech away. Threat's enough. But they said, because we're saying today that's not going to happen, we're dismissing the case. But in dismissing the case, we got incredible rights for Noah. And so just this Wednesday or just this Tuesday, the DFL amended their law, their bylaws, so that people on probation and people who are not citizens of the U.S. can participate in the DFL party. So for everybody that's watching, you brave souls that have made it to the end of this hour, I hope you'll come out and caucus. I don't know if this will come out before the caucus, but folks now, because of Noah's courage, and I just have to say that Noah was strong, he was courageous, and we were able to fight with him and with the DFL, who filed their own suit. Now we have the government's been checked and our power, our community has more rights, and I hope both people that are newly able to caucus and not able to caucus would come out and caucus for me for county attorney.
Caucus. Everybody caucus. Register to caucus. It's happening now. I can't explain to you how to do it. There's various websites you can go
online
to fill out
That's
the forms.
Right.
What is it? Caucus.dfl.org.
That's right.
And then if you're in Minneapolis, you can go to minneapolisdfl.org/2022. So find a website, register to caucus.
And if you'd like to caucus for me, you can go to simonforcountyattorney.com, and we'd love to help you. There's a pre-filled out, partially pre-filled out form for you right there.
I don't appreciate the way you implied that no one would listen to this extremely long episode. Of course they will.
I said for the brave souls that did, not because this is a lot of fun, John, and I really appreciate you having me on and the thoughtful questions. As hard as you were about the Minnetonka question, which was a good question.
Okay, we're going to end it here so we don't intimidate our listeners, because all of them will listen to all 54 minutes. My guest has been Simon Troutman, who is a Richfield City Council member and candidate for Hennepin County Attorney. And I'm your host, John Edwards. This has been the Wedge Live Podcast. Thank you for listening.
Thanks so much, John. It's really great to spend this time.
This is a real thing. Real thing.
None of you have the balls to stop this.
Today.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now. 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 Right now.